Case number 11-3045 et al. United States of America v. Morris B. Fambula, Appellant. Ms. Kate for Appellant Fambula, Mr. Wayne for Appellant Bondo, and Mr. Sabolt for the appellee.
As I suppose everybody knows, Judge Chantel is indisposed, and we'll hear this and all the other matters today on the CDs. Thanks. Ms. Kate.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. My name is Barbara Kate, and I represent the Appellant Morris Fambula. I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I would inform the court that Mr. Wayne and I have divided the time and have divided the issues. And I will be addressing this morning the issues involving the Speedy Trial Act and the issues surrounding subject matter jurisdiction and venue, including a sufficiency argument involving subject matter jurisdiction. Mr. Wayne will address the remaining issues. Your Honor, to take up first the speedy trial issue, we are proceeding from two orders that were issued in the trial court, one by Magistrate Judge Robinson and one by the trial judge, Judge Walton, each of which have their problems, I would argue, each of which are not completely in accord with the higher case law. The government is arguing Tinklenburg, which I would suggest does not hold that cases claiming an exclusion under the foreign evidence rule are automatic exclusions. In fact, in Tinklenburg, they went, or at least Justice Scalia in the concurring opinion went so far as to say, the first six exclusions under the rule may be considered automatic. There are two other exclusions, one being the interest of justice exclusion and the other being the foreign evidence exclusion, which were not mentioned as automatic, and for good reason. The Speedy Trial Act is a statute that is enforced strictly. And
Ms. Kate, which words in subsection 8 are you relying on?
I'm relying on ordered by a district court upon an application of the party. The government not only neglected to transfer my client from New York for 27 days, they then filed a motion for exclusion under Section 8 and were only granted until October 16th of 2009 as an exclusion. They did not renew in writing their motion for exclusion.
The statute doesn't say in writing, right?
That's correct. It doesn't say in writing. However, when Magistrate Judge Robinson advised the government that she expected the motion in writing, and of course it would have afforded my client an opportunity to respond, not to a status report, but to a formal motion, it would have behooved the government to simply, in this day and age of e-filing, to return that afternoon and file their motion.
The magistrate, I understood, gave 3 days to file and said it would be good nunc pro tunc if it were granted, and then the district court did grant it. Is that right?
Well, I would argue that she was without the authority to grant that extension.
Well, maybe she was without the authority to insist on it being on paper, since the statute just says an application. It was in the status report, and it was orally made. Those two are correct, right?
That's correct. But the statute also requires that the district court grant the exclusion. If the government had wanted additional time, they could have appealed Magistrate Kaye's order. They could have, they clearly could have filed. They felt a sense of entitlement under this statute because it's clear that they believed that this, as they argue here in their brief in the case today, that there was some kind of an automatic exclusion. And they neglected every opportunity to move their case along. When Magistrate Judge Robinson ultimately denied their request, they returned an indictment the very next day. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that they ever received a further response from the government of Liberia on their request. And
was the indictment returned before the district court issued the stay in the Speedy Trial Act matter?
What happened was that the Magistrate Judge Robinson on the 17th of December ordered the case dismissed, uh-huh. And the government appealed that order to the chief judge as the presiding judge of the grand jury. And before that could be heard, they returned an indictment on the 18th of December.
So at the moment at which the indictment was issued, the complaint had been dismissed. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's correct.
And the complaint was dismissed without prejudice, right?
Without prejudice.
So what's the problem?
Well, the problem, Judge, is...
All the Speedy Trial Act says is that the indictment has to be within a certain amount of time or the complaint can be dismissed. The complaint was dismissed. The statute says it can be dismissed without prejudice. It was dismissed without prejudice.
But the defendant, my client, defendant Fonbula, did complain of and did argue, and we argue here that Judge Walton found erroneously, that there were several of the factors set forth in the statute which clearly would have suggested that the complaint should have been dismissed with prejudice.
What's our standard of review on with prejudice? This has to be an abuse of discretion by the magistrate judge, or... I mean, if the magistrate judge dismisses with prejudice, none of this is argued in the brief, so it's a little hard to remember, but my recollection is, at best, you have to show an abuse of discretion by the magistrate judge. Isn't that right?
My understanding is that the issues of law relating to the Speedy Trial Act are reviewed de novo, and the issues of fact, the findings of fact, are reviewed for clear error.
What's the issue of law you're pointing to?
The issue of law is the interpretation of the statute with respect to the dismissal with or without prejudice. The law is set forth in the statute as to what factors are to be considered with respect to whether or not the dismissal is with or without prejudice.
But you're not arguing about the interpretation of the language in the statute. You're arguing about the application of the statutory criteria to the case, I take it.
Which sounds like an abuse of discretion standard.
And yet the interpretation of the statute here is that there was no order of the district court extending the Speedy Trial Act, and the case law is clear is that as dawn breaks the next day, the Speedy Trial Act has run. And
okay, so on that day it was dismissed
without prejudice.
Yeah, right. I hadn't really thought about this until you put the dates together, but it seems like you have a bigger problem than I thought.
Well, no, I mean, then I would clearly argue the abuse of discretion. And why it's an abuse of discretion here is that this defendant was not only held in violation of the statute and the rules of criminal procedure for 27 days in New York with no attempt by the government to bring him to Washington, to afford him counsel.
I didn't see you're not actually object. You didn't raise a challenge to that period, did you?
Well, what's interesting is it's because even Judge Walton, who was not actually prone to acts of generosity toward my client, actually saw that issue in his favor. He actually ruled that that no more than 5 days was excludable. He did find the 27 days unreasonable. And so what I'm saying is if you then take that, plus their clear neglect to properly either appeal or file their request for an extension beyond October 16th, and the government's sort of sense of entitlement that it was automatic that they would have this time, when no evidence was forthcoming, that was proven in time that no evidence was forthcoming, and they clearly had the ability to indict at a moment's notice because they did as soon as Magistrate Judge Robinson dismissed the case, then I would argue that it was an abuse of discretion not to have dismissed this case with prejudice. Every prosecutor knows the Speedy Trial Act is strictly enforced, and there were any number of tools in the government's quiver that they could have employed to get this case indicted on time and get it tried on time, and they simply neglected to do
so.
Right,
so you're over time. You had a separate second argument you wanted to make?
The second argument is, and I think it's fairly well briefed, that the funds that were alleged to have been stolen were no longer identifiable as U.S. property. The funds having changed hands so many times as a matter of, one can only assume, convenience to the United States, they passed this money along to charitable organizations and non-governmental organizations, And through various levels within those organizations, so that the funds were no longer property of the United States or could be perceived by the individuals distributing at the end of this literally food chain, to these funds were commingled with donations from other countries. They were passed through many hands and therefore technically, physically were no longer property of the United States and therefore not.
Is this a sufficiency argument?
It is.
On which, this is on conspiracy? The only argument I saw that you raised on sufficiency is about conspiracy, is that right?
I would have to look. I believe so.
So you have, I think it's the Tepper case that says that Supreme Court, that doesn't matter how many things it's how many places it passes through, as long as the person knows a misrepresentation will be made to the United States in order to get the funds. That's sufficient. Why isn't that what we have here?
Because there was no proof with respect to Mr. Fonbula particularly that he understood there to be any misrepresentation. The government...
No proof, slight overstatement on that point?
Perhaps a slight overstatement, but I think it's also an overstatement for the government to claim it was overwhelming and clear. I think that it was very unclear.
The only issue... I'm sorry.
I mean, I guess the standard is just, sorry, that as long as any rational fact finder could find in favor of the government.
But the issue here is the subject matter jurisdiction, whether or not it was proven that he intended to steal from the United States, funds of the United States, and whether they were actually still funds.
So it's not a sufficiency argument, it's a jurisdiction argument you're making, is that right?
Well, the government's argument back is that however they charge it, if they charge it as a crime against the United States, then it becomes a proof issue as to they have properly charged it, but then the question is whether the proof returns sufficient to support that subject matter jurisdiction. Argument is that it did not. The proof did not come in at trial sufficient to support the subject matter jurisdiction that was claimed.
Well, that sounds like a sufficiency claim rather than a jurisdictional claim. And then you have the rational fact finder standard.
But I don't believe that a rational fact finder on these facts, with the commingling both of funds and the transfer of commodity, could have found that this was still property of the United States.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, Charles Wayne for Appellant Bondo. Unless the court has a preference, I would like to start by dealing with the issues related to the sentencing. The government had the burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence of establishing the amount of loss and the number of victims. There was a total failure of proof in this regard. So the court, without a proper and reliable factual basis to support the amount of loss and the number of victims, miscalculated Mr. Bondo's sentence as a matter of law. Now, since the Booker case, it's the law, certainly in this circuit and elsewhere, that when a court commits a legal error, if it acts unreasonably in the process of taking the guidelines into account during the sentencing process. And here the judge did so. Make that error, and it's not a harmless error.
You also don't think it's a slight overstatement to say there was a total failure of proof?
Yes, there is no proof in the record. There's no competent proof in the record as to the amount of loss.
So it's not that there was no proof, it's that you think the proof wasn't competent. There were affidavits with respect to the number of people, and there was a document, a summary document with respect to the amount of the loss, right?
But it didn't prove the amount of the loss. There was a... First of all, that summary document purportedly summarized an audit, which was never admitted into evidence. The number that was relied on by the government and by the judge was the fact that the non-governmental organization here, World Vision Incorporated, repaid $1.9 million. So that's the number that was used. That doesn't prove that that was the loss. In fact, there were three things that were allegedly diverted here: food, construction materials, and labor. There is no proof in the record anywhere, whether at trial or at sentencing, as to the value of any amount of those three things.
What was that payment supposed to be for?
I'm sorry?
What was the payment supposed to be for? In other words, $1.9 million is for something.
Correct.
And what is that something?
What it was supposed to be used for? To buy food, construction materials, and in effect, it's said to pay for labor, but this program we're talking about is a food for labor program. A village that did not have a latrine would build a latrine, and the people who participated in the building would be paid with food. That's the way the program was to work. But what was never shown was what was diverted. Again, there's three categories of things we're talking about here: the food, the construction materials, and the labor. There was never any proof as to any of those as to what was diverted. In fact, at trial, there was and this gets into some of the evidentiary points, the 10,000 pages that were improperly admitted as business records, and the Rule 1006 summary exhibit of those 10,000 pages, none of those give any detail at all as to the amount of the loss. And in fact, at sentencing, there was an improved version, Rule 1006 summary exhibit, which is Government's Exhibit 104. An improved version of that was offered by the government at sentencing that purported to give more detail, but it did not. For example, it said that there was $14,000 worth of construction materials diverted. There's no detail whatsoever beyond that as to construction materials. What was relied on by the judge was the check that was written by World Vision, the non-governmental organization, to reimburse the Catholic Relief Services and AID. Again, and there was a victim impact statement that was submitted, but again, not considered by the court, where World Vision sought to justify why they paid the $1.9 million. It's really not relevant as to proving the amount, but that was a document written for their insurance company to show why it was that they should be reimbursed by the insurance company for the $1.9 million check that they wrote. The court will look in vain both at the trial record and at the sentencing record for any evidence that goes to show the amount of the loss. And Chief Judge Garland, with regard to the victims, what Judge Walton focused on were three affidavits out of the many affidavits. Three statements that were unsworn by three chiefs of three different villages who were illiterate, who said that they had 105 people, 120 people, 130 people in their villages, and that they did work and that they did not get food. Okay. This isn't the type of reliable evidence that's contemplated by, even under the relaxed evidentiary standards that hold at a sentencing hearing, whether both with regard to hearsay and the other evidentiary rules.
Well, there aren't any evidentiary rules that apply at the sentencing, so...
I'm sorry?
There aren't any evidentiary rules that apply at sentencing.
That is right? Effectively true, yes.
Not effectively true. That's what the sentencing guidelines say. So the question is whether it was reasonable for the judge to rely on these three affidavits. Certainly it is reasonable to rely on affidavits in general. And then the question is, what's our standard of review of the district court's decision that he's going to take these to be reliable? They have three chiefs from the three villages who say their people did work and weren't paid, and the number of people, which is only three villages out of this, over 100 villages that were listed, right?
That's all true.
Why was it unreasonable for the district court to think that there could be that many people if you're only looking at three villages, which already puts you over the 250 number of victims, that the additional evidence would be more than sufficient?
It's unreasonable for this reason. First of all, they weren't affidavits. They were unsworn statements.
Okay,
number
unsworn
one,
statements.
Written by other people, and the three chiefs, like the rest of the chiefs, could neither read nor write. So that's one thing. So it's got to be reliable. It wasn't, under the circumstances, it was not reliable. One chief testified at the trial. That chief, when asked, and this is in our brief, when asked, did your people do work and get food in return for the work? The answer was yes. He said, did you have any problem with that? Yes, we didn't think we got enough. Okay, so that's the only evidence we have in this case, and the only competent evidence of what happened. We've got a chief who said, yes, the food for work program did in fact operate. They did work. They did get food. He complained that it wasn't enough.
Was he one? He wasn't one of these three.
He was not one of the three. That is correct. So based on, again, and that was not taken into account in the sentencing. And what happened was, as a result of the, we get, there's a bump up of 35 levels between the amount of the loss and the amount of the victims. From, and we're talking about a sentence, the difference in the sentence between 12 to 18 months all the way up to, you know, well in excess of 10 years. And I would note that both of these defendants have been incarcerated pre-trial and have already been in jail for about 53, 54 months. And what should have happened here at sentencing, those, both the amount of the loss, the judge should have recognized that the amount of the loss had not been proved and the amount of the victims had not been proved. And the correct, and in his calculation, and taking the guidelines into account, the correct range, the correct level was level 13, 12 to 18 months. And that was an abuse of discretion. And moreover,
well, you have more than one argument, right?
I do. That
you're
is true.
You're out of time, so you should try to move to the next one.
I'll do that. My other primary arguments I've touched on briefly, which have to do with the admission of the business, so-called business records, the fact that the witness through whom that evidence was introduced was not competent to testify, was not competent to lay the proper foundation.
What wasn't competent about him?
He did not, he had no knowledge of the documents. He didn't supervise the compilation of the data.
Are you talking about for the, now you're switching between the business records and the summary, right? Which one?
Both.
You can
the business
both,
records.
Let's do one at a time.
Okay, we'll do the business
so
records
the
first.
So the business records one, the question is of the custodian. We've held, I think every other court has held, that the custodian doesn't have to have personal knowledge of the creation of the documents. That would be impossible for custodians of large corporations. All he has to do is say that he has enough knowledge to testify about the organization's procedures, about how these documents would be collected and put together. And
agreed.
He did testify to that. So why wasn't that enough for foundation?
Okay. He did not testify to that. I would submit to you, the court, that the program first was completed before he arrived.
But that could be true of any new custodian.
Correct.
And if that were the rule, any company that ever fired a custodian would never be able to get business records in.
That is true.
And you agree that's not the rule?
I agree.
All right, so it doesn't matter that he wasn't there at the time.
He never reviewed the 10,000 pages. He could not testify about the time gap. Part of it, as Your Honor knows, but with regard to business records, it has to be regularly conducted activity, and it has to be regularly conducted activity must be close in time to the recording of the data.
I thought he testified that that was the procedure, that it would have been done at the time. He doesn't have to know about a specific document. He just has to know about the procedure.
He testified. There was no proper foundation laid. All this came out on cross-examination. And what came out on cross-examination, this was after it was admitted, what came out on cross-examination was that he couldn't testify about the time gap and the fact that he was uncertain how the organization used the documents. In fact, he was uncertain as to the content of the 36 binders that held the 10,000 pages. So he is not a proper custodian. He did not have the proper knowledge. He testified only in the vaguest sense as to, you know, that there were forms 1 through 8 in these 36 binders. That's not laying a proper foundation under the business records exception. So, and that's
your principal argument was that these are false documents anyway. That the government's position is these are false documents.
That is true. That is the government's position.
Well, if they're false documents, then it doesn't matter, right? Because they're not submitted for the truth.
They were submitted. They were in fact submitted for the truth. The government attempted to argue that in its brief as its second argument that they were not submitted for the truth, but they were, in fact, submitted for the truth, and that's why we made the argument, as we did in our reply brief.
When you say they were submitted for the truth, are you saying that, as a matter of fact, they were submitted for the truth because that's the colloquy that occurred, or are you saying that you actually think that they were submitted for the truth of what's in the documents?
I'm saying that the government, as we argued in our reply brief, the government submitted them for the truth. The truth in this case is that these documents were false.
The truth is that the documents are false.
Okay, and we cite the Adefahinti case where the court dealt with this issue. So
every false document, every false statement is submitted for the truth of the fact that it's false. So every false statement is actually hearsay?
I mean, not necessarily. Well, no, it could be an admission of a party opponent, or it could be a lot of things.
If a check has been forged and submitted to show it's been forged, not for the truth, is it being submitted for the truth of the fact that it's forged? Or is it being submitted as a forged statement by the defendant?
I think that regardless of what label is, Your Honor's given it two descriptions, both of those are accurate.
Well, the case law is quite clear that the check comes in not as a business record, but as a false statement.
Correct.
So, and not admitted for the truth. It strikes me that there's two different things going on here. There's parts of these documents that are business records, namely the form. This is the kind of form you're supposed to fill out to show that food's been distributed. So the general aspect of the document as one which is then submitted up the chain and ultimately gets paid by the United States through AID. That part's a business record.
That's correct.
But the false statements in the document are not submitted for the truth. Those are submitted as false statements.
I agree with Your Honor.
So then the only thing if that's true, then the only thing custodian has to testify is what these kinds of documents are used for and the general way in which they're used, not really anything with respect to the content of the particular document.
But what is required by Rule 1006...
Now you're on the summary issue, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Go ahead.
If I can move to that.
Yeah.
Is that, first of all, the 10,000 pages had to be admissible, which we say they are not. The witness had no knowledge and had no role in the preparation of the documents. He was not, as Your Honor knows and as Your Honor pointed out, Rule 1006 developed in the old days that we would have called it a ledger, and now we call it an Excel spreadsheet, but information comes from many sources to a person or persons who compile those, and we don't have to call everyone in that supplied the information. We only have to put the person who knows about who either compiled the information or knows about the compilation of the information. This witness, Mr. Fulov, did not fulfill any of those roles. He didn't know. He certainly wasn't the person who compiled it, and he didn't know about the compilation. That is required under Rule 1006 for a summary exhibit to come in. He doesn't have to do it himself, and the government said that we said that he did. He doesn't have to do it himself, but he didn't even supervise the person who did it. And he was not even sure if the summary exhibit, Government Exhibit 104, summarized the 10,000 pages that it purported to do so. He did not know that. This is his testimony, again, on cross-examination after it had been admitted. So the foundation was not laid for Rule 1006. And I would stress, and I know my time is up, but I would stress that these documents are the guts of the government's case, the guts of the government's documentary case against the two defendants. Thank you.
Thank you. Here's my turn.
May it please the Court, David Sable on behalf of the United States. Good morning. Turning first to the speedy trial issue. The government is not submitting that the foreign evidence exclusion is an automatic exclusion. It requires two findings by a preponderance of the evidence, which Judge Walton did make. And the court did not err in making these findings, did not clearly err in making these findings, and appellants do not urge that it did. The court found by a preponderance that the government had made a request for evidence in January of 2009, and that this evidence reasonably appeared to be in Liberia. And Judge Walton concluded that if it found by preponderance that these two things had happened, it had no discretion and had to order the foreign evidence exclusion. And it did so retroactively. It's worth noting that the government at every stage of the procedure requested that the speedy trial and exclusion under the foreign evidence exclusion, and those requests were timely made.
Can I ask you a question about what happened in Bondo's case? So it looks like the magistrate gave the government up to a year right at the outset.
Up to a year, yes. Yeah. Meaning, magistrate judge Bondo was arrested in New York. Bondo was arrested, I'm sorry, not in New York, in May. And on June 2nd, magistrate judge Fasciola issued an order at the government's request that the government had up to a year. Up to a year meaning when you get the documents, you no longer get any more time. That's the plain meaning of up to a year.
So the year was the outside, and the arrangement was that...
Exactly. And then Judge... Yeah.
And it wasn't the same with the other defendant, though?
With Fambula, he was arrested in July in New York, on July 15th, brought down to D.C., presented before Magistrate Judge Kay, and Magistrate Judge Kay excluded from the day of the arrest until October 16th. On October 16th, the government appeared before Magistrate Judge Robinson and orally moved to exclude time, which of course stopped the clock right then. She said, I want a written motion. The government filed a written motion 3 days later. Appellant then responded with a motion to dismiss the indictment, which Magistrate Judge Robinson dismissed without prejudice on December 16th. And it's worth noting, and I would say, in Fambula's appendix at page 83, the Magistrate Judge Robinson said, the dismissal for which the undersigned's order provides is a dismissal without prejudice. Indeed, defendant did not request dismissal with prejudice. So I believe, Judge Garland, you were thinking about the Bowman case, where obviously the dismissal without prejudice restarts the clock. And so that is what happened here with Mr. Fambula.
So just on the timing, which I'm afraid wasn't clear to me before, the day that the complaint was dismissed without prejudice, how many days after that was the indictment?
2 days, Your Honor.
And during that period...
I thought it was the 16th.
But what matters to me is during that period, the district court had not stayed the magistrate's order yet. Is that right? Or had it?
I believe it had stayed the order.
The complaint was not dismissed.
I would need to look at the record. By the time the parties got in front of Chief Judge Lamberth, the parties agreed that the issue was moot. Whether it was stayed pending the order in front of Judge Lamberth or not, the hearing in front of Judge Lamberth, I would need to look again at the record.
Okay. Did the government file its paper motion on the same day the complaint was dismissed?
The government's motion was filed on October, written motion was filed on October 19th. Which motion is the court referring to?
The magistrate said, transcript of the magistrate's, of the discussion before the magistrate was that the government had filed a request to extend in its status report and that it was orally making that request. The magistrate said she would like it on paper. What day was the paper filed?
Thank you, Your Honor. I understand the court's question now. The government moved 3 times in October before Magistrate Judge Kay's initial exclusion expired, in writing on the status report, orally on the 16th in front of Judge Robinson, and then in writing again on the 19th per Judge Robinson's order. And then Judge Robinson didn't rule for 2 months, during which time appellant Fambula responded, and then the court obviously considered it.
Okay, thank you.
Turning then, if the court has no further questions on speedy trial, to issues of sufficiency. First of all, I would note the funds were not commingled. These were all U.S. government funds. With respect to the sufficiency of the proof of misrepresentation, Five employees, Your Honor, World Vision Liberia, testified that they participated in a conspiracy to create documents for food that was never delivered, latrines that were not built, construction materials that were not delivered, and that their supervisors in the scheme, not just in the World Vision, were Parker, Bondo, and Fambula. And there were numerous statements elicited by Mr. Fambula, which indicated that he knew and was participating in this conspiracy. Moreover, he was in charge of strictly verifying these reports and sending them back. And there was abundant evidence of reports that he emailed back to Washington, D.C. He was copied on emails, finance reports generated by his office, which listed pages of budget information, income streams from USAID, income streams from the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, which is part of USAID. So he was well aware that these were U.S. government funds and that the object of the conspiracy was the U.S. government thwarting a U.S. government aid program. Turning to sentencing, Your Honor, I would take issue with what Appellant Bondo said on the sentencing issue. The court did not err in finding that $1.9 million was a reasonable amount. There's a two-tiered analysis here, but the court doesn't need to proceed to the second tier. Judge Walton, it is correct, relied exclusively on trial evidence in finding the reasonable amount of the loss. At trial, the witnesses testified that World Vision paid $1.9 million. That was the amount of the loss, and in particular, the guidelines provide for a reasonable estimate of the loss, and $1.9 million was also the quote-unquote harm resulting from the offense. That's what World Vision had to pay. And, of course, World Vision had no incentive to inflate this figure because the money was coming out of their own pocket. Even though they did receive some insurance reimbursement, they had no incentive to inflate the figure. If the court doesn't need to look beyond to the methodology, but if the court elects to do so, it's worth just mentioning what the methodology was here. There was trial testimony that World Vision conducted an audit, that its auditors went to Liberia and gathered all the documents, that they interviewed World Vision employees, that they interviewed the town chiefs and village elders who received the reportedly received the food. All this evidence came out at trial and subject to cross-examination. The only
when you say that the district court relied only on the fact that World Vision paid $1.9 million, why do you say that, given that the district court heard the trial testimony and knew about the audit, I assume got the victim impact statement?
That's correct. Your Honor, if I said that, then I misspoke. The trial court said, I'm relying only on what came out at trial. And I'm arguing that
the fact that World Vision paid $1.9 million is not the only thing that came out of the trial.
Exactly so. And I'm sorry.
Well, I'm asking. I don't know the answer to that. It's a big transcript.
Right.
I didn't read the whole thing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a discussion where the court talks to the prosecutor. The prosecutor says, this is exactly what came out of trial. And all the facts that I've just listed, the only fact that did not come out of trial was that when the village elders were interviewed, they said, we only got so much food. We only got 10% of the food that was supposed to arrive. And so, I mean, they didn't know what 10% was, but when they did the math, they found they only received 10%. And so the program claimed, the raw data in the program claimed, and this was what was summarized in the summary exhibit, that 3,250 metric tons of wheat, of bulgur, lentils, and oil were delivered to three counties in Liberia. 3,000 tons. When they added up what people said they received, they only got 10%.
This raises sort of the elephant in the room question here. What happened to those tons? Well, there's no testimony at all about what happened to that, is there?
There was some testimony at trial. The jury did not find as an overt act the diversion of the food. Of course, that the court could still rely on diversion of food, but the theory of the government's case was that it was being diverted on the black market.
And that the money was being paid back to Bondo and Fambula?
Exactly so. And they did pay some bribes to the food monitors who were
Was there any And do you have any bank accounts of Bondo or Von Bula showing? That's a lot of money. You would think you would be able to trace that amount.
Not necessarily a lot of money, because selling food in a starving country is not a great fraud model, but nonetheless, that is what they appear to have been doing, yes. But no, that evidence was not there, Your Honor. The evidence that the government, there was evidence that Bondo carried a bag of cash, that he responded to a bogus effort to sell some food, and that he was running around trying to sell some food. But that was not the thrust of the government's case. The thrust of the government's case was the fraudulent documents that were sent back to Washington, D.C.
Defense counsel in the brief argues that World Vision did have an incentive to overpay because they had to maintain good relations with AID and with Catholic Relief Services.
Well, that was not raised below. That argument, it was not an argument that the court had an opportunity to consider.
This wasn't raised at the sentencing hearing?
Was raised at the sentencing hearing was, Judge, you can't rely on these village elders. They have an incentive to lie and say they didn't get food so they can get more food. And the court expressly found there's no evidence to support that claim.
Argument for not relying on the 1.9 million? What was their argument in the sentencing hearing about why the $1.9 million payment that World Vision made to pay back the grant wasn't a fair evaluation of loss?
Van Bula's argument was, I don't think it's 1.9, but I can't get the number under 1 million. So Van Bula conceded in his sentencing memo that the number was of loss was at least $1 million, which is the same 16-point adjustment because the range is 1 million to 2.5. And so that's why we argued either that he has forfeited or wait. You
know,
or
and Mr. Bondo?
Mr. Bondo simply said that the number wasn't equitably or something like numerically based. And that was the extent of his argument.
Okay. You want to say something about the number of victims before we move
yes.
on?
Yes. It was reliable. The hearsay that the court considered at sentencing with respect to the victims was reliable. It was corroborated by the testimony of the World Vision employees who said, almost all the food distribution records that I created were fraudulent. We never distributed this food. And so it's not surprising that the village elders are saying, yes, we didn't get this food either. It corroborates that information. I would like to say something about the summary exhibit, if I may, Your Honor.
Please.
The summary exhibit was nothing more than a mathematical tabulation of the underlying documents. The summary exhibit, the underlying documents, all listed. We said we gave out this much bulgur, this many lentils, this many kilograms of oil. The summary exhibit was nothing but a mathematical tabulation of these documents to reach a number of 3,250 metric tons of food. And so 90% of that food, going back to the sentencing, if I may just make one point, 90% of that food did not arrive in the villages. The value of that food plus shipping and warehousing is $1.9 million, and that's how World Vision arrived at the amount. That's the underlying methodology, which this court doesn't need to get to, but that's what was reflected in the victim impact statement from World Vision.
Please.
I was going to say, on the underlying documents beneath the summary, so they, as a matter of fact, they were sought to be introduced at trial for the truth?
They were introduced at trial under the business records exception.
And the argument was that they would be introduced for the truth?
The argument was they should be admitted under the business record exception, but the government never argued that the contents of them were true. The government always argued that the contents of this information, there was fictitious information in these documents, but that World Vision, CRS, USAID relied on them in the ordinary course of their business, and that the government was laying a foundation for later showing that the contents of the documents were false. It's just like the check case in Tan, where the forged check, well, that's the different rationale. But Adafahinti is our argument for the business record exception, and then Tan and the Supreme Court case in Anderson is our argument for...
You said that the summary exhibit merely adds up things from those documents.
Yes.
Adds up true things or false things?
It adds up the representations that were made.
Representations about the amount of food that was distributed?
Exactly. Then independent evidence showed that those representations were false. And so it's the contrast between the independent evidence, which the jury found was credible, and the claims, which the jury found were false, that gives the loss figure.
Just say something again about the relationship here. The purpose of the summary was to show the total amount of distribution of food that was false or that was true.
Is the court asking about trial?
Yes, let's start with trial, yes.
The evidentiary, the document was proffered as an evidentiary basis to show a mathematical tabulation of the food that was claimed to have been distributed.
I see. And what was the evidence? What was the evidence of the food that was actually delivered?
The evidence of the food that was actually delivered at trial was the evidence from the monitors who said, we never distributed this food. Five employees of World Vision said, we never distributed this food. We almost never distributed this food. And we simply sat next to Van Bula's office using all 10 of our fingers.
So at trial, the purpose, regardless of how you presented it, the purpose was to show a large amount that was not actually distributed. Is that right?
Correct. And how large the amount was not quantified at trial.
And not really relevant at trial.
It wasn't relevant.
Now what about at sentencing?
At sentencing, the court relied on the trial testimony, which showed that the loss, as calculated by World Vision, was $1.9 million, and that's what they paid.
What was the purpose of the enhanced summary exhibit 104 at sentencing?
To unpack the methodology for arriving at the $1.9 million figure.
But your representation was that it was false, that those distributions didn't occur. So how does
but how
get
false?
To that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. How false? Uh-huh. So question is, they say we delivered almost, at trial, the monitor said, we delivered almost none of this food. And so at sentencing, they said almost none means 10%, and we know that because we went out and interviewed the 258 town chiefs, and they said, we compared what they said they got to what the documents claim they got, and they got 10% of 3,250 metric tons. And so we calculate they didn't get 90% of this food. And so 90% of this food, plus warehousing and shipping, is $1.9 million. That's what we owe the government.
Okay. Okay.
If the court has nothing further, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, Your Honor, let me amplify the record. The court asked whether or not there was an order granting the stay of dismissal. It was. It was ordered the same day. Magistrate Judge Robinson issues her order on the 17th, the same day the government files its emergency petition for a stay, and the same day that stay is ordered, the 17th. The next day, the indictment is returned, and 3 days later, they appear before the chief judge to say it is now moot.
Okay. So that's our colloquy was worthless because, in fact, I'm not worthless, but interesting, but not really a ground to dispose of the argument one way or the other, correct? Because, in fact, the complaint wasn't dismissed before the indictment came down, right? It was stayed.
It was stayed.
So it wasn't dismissed.
What I would like to address in rebuttal, though, briefly, Your Honor, is this issue that appears to be troubling the court with respect to these business records. Clearly, the government used them for the truth of the documents. They say it was the thrust of their case, and they say that it was used to corroborate their witnesses, witnesses that needed corroboration because they had issues with respect to credibility. So, again, they were using the documents. But the purpose of a records custodian is not just to tell you what these documents are used for. The purpose of a records custodian is also to tell you the methodology from which the documents were retrieved so that we know that this is a reliable set of documents, that we have all of the documents. And in a case where they're claiming only 10% of the food was delivered, and we know this because of these documents, it's that much more important that the records custodian be able to at least affirm that there aren't three more warehouses full of documents somewhere in Liberia that show the distribution.
So these are all documents in which the government's claim and the witness's claim is that they were not actually distributed.
Right.
Right.
And how do we know that these are all of the documents? Well, he had no clue.
Well, that's a different question. He's not the custodian for all the documents. He's custodian for these documents. You want to put out, find more documents? You need to do discovery and get those documents. But I don't understand how that goes to this question.
Because the government's representation is that food was not distributed. We know this to be true because when we look at these companies' records, we only see false documents. Well, we don't know that we're seeing all of the documents.
No, but I take it from the colloquy we just had with the government counsel, these were to show that this amount of food was not distributed. All the amount listed on these documents was not distributed. Maybe some other amount was, but the total on this amount, on this, which totals above $1.9 million, which is a different question. The amount doesn't really matter. This amount wasn't distributed.
It does not. These documents do not represent 90% of a distribution that was not made.
Now you're on sentencing, which I understand you gave up on anyway below. So you're not really the right person to argue the sentencing argument, right? Yeah, not you, but defense counsel below, according to the government, conceded that they couldn't show less than $1 million, right?
I think they conceded that the company had come forward with this figure of 1.9, which is the contract amount. It couldn't have been any more than that. The fact that they tried to stay in the government's good graces in order to be able to continue to contract with the government by reimbursing them for the contract amount doesn't mean that that's the amount that was left undelivered. And these documents, which they claim are false, but they then present as true, do not prove that 90% of anything was diverted or 90% of the food was left undelivered. This records custodian, I mean, Judge Walton time and again puts the questions out there for the government to ask, and the government doesn't ask them because they know this witness is not the proper custodian to respond to all of the foundation questions. They try over and over and over again to explain to the government this is the foundation you need, and they don't ask those questions because they know that the foundational answers are not forthcoming. And they can say these documents are false, but they then argue that they can be trusted, and they can be trusted for very significant purposes throughout the trial and sentencing, the amount of loss, and to corroborate witnesses who had credibility issues. And that's why they can't have it both ways. They can't say they're admissible because they're false and therefore not hearsay, and at the same time say that they're true for the purposes that they choose, and that this records custodian properly authenticated the business records of this company when he can't even say he knows where they came from and that production was complete.
Okay.
I don't know why it says I have 3 minutes and 20 seconds left. Oh, I'm over by 3 minutes and 20 seconds. Okay.
Which we're going to take away from your co-counsel. No, I'm just kidding. All right.
Quick, I'll be brief, Your Honor, if I could address a sentencing issue. There's a disconnect here and the government has put forth. And this disconnect is this, that, as Your Honor put it, the enhanced version of Government Exhibit 104 that was submitted at sentencing purports to show the results of a so-called forensic audit. The forensic audit was never admitted into evidence. It was discussed at trial. And, in fact, the government said at trial, we're not seeking to admit it into evidence. We don't want it in evidence. So it never came in, okay, number one. Now, when you look at that enhanced version of Government Exhibit 104, it purports to show, again, the 91% of the food and $14,000 worth of tools were diverted. It says nothing about labor. But as I said, the forensic audit was never admitted into evidence. And those in that 91%, you will look in vain at those 10,000 pages that supposedly are part of the audit for information that would give you this 91%. Now, with regard to the $1.9 million, as Your Honor, as Chief Judge Garland, you pointed out, Mr. Buono did contest that amount below. But contrary to what government counsel has said, World Vision paid $1.9 million because that's the amount that AID demanded. period, end of sentence. Okay? The grant was $1.9 million. It went to a non-governmental organization called Catholic Relief Services. Okay? It took, for its administrative fee, $760,000. Again, this is in the record and in the briefs. And World Vision Liberia, or World Vision and then World Vision Liberia, got $1.24 million. So $1.9 million never made it to Liberia in any form, nor was it ever intended to. So $1.9 million cannot be the number. And for the same reason that I've gone into with regard to the unreliability, 1.24 can't be the number either. Then simply the audit was not admitted. There was no proof of diversion of food. And in fact, Mr. Bondo was acquitted of the charge of diverting food. He was acquitted of the charge that he got proceeds from the sale of foods. He was acquitted of the charge that he directed World Vision employees to divert construction materials. Given that, okay, this is all in the verdict form, given that, how can anyone tell from the state of this record what the, quote, amount of loss was? That's why we say there was a failure of proof and why we are asking that this be remanded to Judge Walton for resentencing without the enhancement for both the amount of the loss and the amount of victims. That would give a range at the level 13 of 12 to 18 months. Thank you.
Thank you.
Unless the court has questions.
No, take the matter under submission. Thank you.